WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Sheila Ballantyne writes both funny and serious stories. In her new collection of six stories, Life on Earth, she turns her comic ear to issues of death and mortality. The first three stories are about the sometimes absurd details surrounding the business of death. The other stories are more reflective, marking changes over the 14 years she wrote these stories. Ballantyne has written two novels, Norma Jean, The Termite Queen, and Imaginary Crimes. Norma Jean, her best-known novel, was written in 1975, and it's still in print. It's about a housewife who wants to change her suburban existence. It's a comic novel of family life tinged with imaginings of horrid deaths inspired by those ghastly newspaper fillers. Ballantyne teaches writing at Mills College in Oakland, California, and contributes frequently to the New York Times book review section. I asked Sheila Ballantyne to read from her story, Perpetual Care, which received the O. Henry Award for Best Short Story in 1977. In the story, the narrator visits a columbarium, a depository for ashes, to collect her father's remains.
I became aware of a strange sound and, turning, noticed the 12-foot water fountain cascading at the far end of the hall. It had orange spotlights playing on it. There were also 6 to 8 gigantic tanks of tropical fish. Do you have anything like that in your columbarium? Well, you haven't heard the half of it, V.O. There were carpets, ramps, and, are you ready, muzak. But that isn't what knocked me out. The columbarium in Oakland has that, organ music muzak. My first visit there, I went crazy looking for the man playing the organ. It wasn't until I'd covered the entire place that I realized it was coming out of the ceiling. No, it wasn't that the trend is undoubtedly toward muzak in mausoleums. It was that here, in this isolated architect-designed death house on a windswept hill, dead center of the far west, they were playing You and the Night and the Music. I couldn't help myself, V.O. I started dancing. The caretaker was in the washroom filling the water vases. I wouldn't have done it with him around. I danced up the ramp, past the colored fountain, to the upper level. By this time, the tune on the tape was, It Had to Be You. I couldn't help slowing down. I was on the verge of tears.
That was from your story, Perpetual Care, set there in a columbarium. There's a lot of emotional turmoil that comes up at funerals, and we tend to distance ourselves by using euphemisms. So-and-so's passed on, they've passed away, they're no longer here. Bankers sometimes say, well, the will has matured.
Never heard that one.
You know, there's just something that we cannot bring ourselves to say that someone died or to speak of death in very frank terms. And one thing about your stories is that they grasp it. And you deal very frankly with this issue. Was this something painful for you to do?
Well, I think, yes, it was, but more to the point, it was urgent. I have been accused, in this book in particular, of being death-obsessed because there happened to be quite a few, if not all, of the stories in one way or another concern themselves with issues of mortality. And I don't experience it that way. I don't perceive it that way, although I could see why others might, for the very reasons you cited. I see my strongest guiding feeling throughout was one of wishing to explore extreme regions, really, inner emotional states and mental regions that are, I guess, triggered or ignited by crises.
I was struck by an observation you made in the book about how people, say, in middle-aged, are buffered from the idea of immortality because their parents are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But when their parents die, then there's no one left between themselves and eternity. Could you explore a bit about how you thought about this? And
well, I think that is the guiding issue with the first three stories, that you could almost say that one doesn't get to write about certain subjects until certain things in reality will trigger events that then force them to. I mean, I think all writers write in order to shape existence in some way, or at least to reshape it as a means of trying to make some sense out of it. Because, I mean, life is pretty random and chaotic. So you could say that the bottom line is that if you write about it, you get to control it, you get to shape it, you get to perhaps and by doing so find some answers for yourself, or maybe find no answers and then accept that there are no answers. But at least you've gone through the process, and I think certain life events do trigger the impulse to explore things that are, I mean, in my case, just incomprehensible. I mean, obviously, we don't always go around thinking, why are we here? But fundamentally, we do at some point.
Your comment about the buffer that an older generation serves for a younger generation to keep them from facing the questions of mortality is, I think, in some ways moot nowadays with people dying of drug overdoses, people dying of AIDS.
It has completely reversed itself in some ways.
Do you see your book as a guide?
No.
To coping with these issues in any way?
I've received some mail that would suggest that it may become that. I mean, it already has in some instances. I do think that one of the reasons we read literature is to find reflections and echoes of things in our lives and see how they're addressed by other people. And so in that sense, I think everything that's written that's true will find its audience.
I want to tell you a couple of stories about my grandmother. My grandmother, I think, knew that her time was near, and sometimes I'd call her to find out how she was doing. And she would say, well, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to Hill and Hill, being the family mortuary. That's how she'd preface her adventures that she was having. And she'd kind of laugh about it. It was like she reached a certain point of like 85, and mm-hmm. and she was ready.
In other words, it was already prefigured in her mind. It became a kind of dominant image.
Well, I just think that she was aware of it,
mm-hmm.
and she would say, and she would laugh about it. I mean, she knows that this is how life ends, and so she incorporated that as part of her general sort of humor of the world.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt also, when taking her ashes to be buried, stopped off at a restaurant the night before and put the tin up on the table
mm-hmm.
so that my aunt and my grandmother could have a last martini together.
Now, why don't you write about that? That's your story.
But it seems that's one of the things about your first stories in your book that resonated with me in my experience with death. I've had friends who've died of sudden accidental death.
Mm-hmm.
As well as people who've died of old age. And my reaction in each case is somehow different. But there's something comforting about the notion of humor and this odd sort of sense of the peripheral activities that go around someone's death.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's possible that those get written about partly as comic relief. I mean, you have to have some relief on this subject. And as a kind of diversion, a diversionary tactic, you know, that sometimes instead of staring at something head on, I mean, it's like looking into the sun. If you look at the sun, you essentially look around it. You're aware of it, but it's so overwhelming. I mean, you'd be blinded by it. And I think that these details tend to carry more weight for that reason.
Well, do you feel writing here about death has been sort of a dead end, so to speak? I mean, if you've written about death as sort of the subject where you're ultimately straining your sense of imagination.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you just come back to writing about ordinary life?
It's a big problem. Well, in a way, it's a relief uh-huh. to come back to ordinary life. And I think that one of the things that hasn't been too often mentioned about life on Earth is that, yes, these are the things that are being addressed, but that in the end, this we are here. This is our time. This is our life on Earth. And for me, it's almost as though one has to come full cycle in order to really appreciate that this is the only life we have, and its task is to live it well.
Well, Sheila Ballantyne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheila Ballantyne's new collection of short stories, Life on Earth, is published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air.